Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Tonight we present the third in our series of programs containing excerpts taken from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, held this spring at Boston University and sponsored by the Partisan Review. Last week we heard lectures by inventor and entrepreneur Raymond Kurzweil and Dr. Gerald Weissman of New York University School of Medicine. The topic was the ascendance of science and technology, and we continue with that topic on this evening's program. Tonight, we'll first hear from Professor James Collins of the School of Engineering, whose research interests include nonlinear dynamics in biology and physiology and synthetic gene networks. Following that lecture, we'll hear again from Professor Collins, Dr. Weissman, and Mr. Kurzweil, as all three respond to the question, should we call a halt to certain kinds of scientific inquiries because of Faustian dangers? Professor Collins.
I'm Jim Collins. When Edith called me a few months ago and invited me to speak at the conference, I was a little shocked and said, are you sure you have the right Collins? I am not the famous Collins associated with the Human Genome Project. I'm the guy here in biomedical engineering. She says, oh, no, you're the guy we want. And so when I then somehow said yes to this conference, I sat back and thought, well, what could I tell you folks about? And the title that I have in the program is Physics Meets Biology, the Ascendance of Interdisciplinary Science. What I want to do over the next 20 minutes is just give you a case study of a project at this interface of physics and biology that I hope gives you a sense of how some projects in science unfold, give you some sense of some of the culture of science, and also give you a sense of specifically then how different ideas in physics and engineering can inform us at the level of genes. And by way of background, I was trained originally as a physicist and then did graduate work in medical engineering. I joined BU 12 years ago, and my program primarily focuses on taking different ideas from physics and engineering to develop new devices and techniques for characterizing, mimicking, or improving biological function. And up until 6 years ago, all of the work in my lab was focused on different problems or systems that you could actually see with the naked eye. So we did and still do a lot of work that looks at the whole body. How do you maintain balance? How do we walk? What happens when you get older, when you have a high propensity to fall, for instance? So really, up until just about 6 years ago, if I ever put a slide up that had DNA on it, it would stand for does not apply. So how did a guy like me start playing around with genes and different problems with genome? Well, just by way of a short anecdote, it actually goes back about 6 years ago here at BU. At the time, I was part of the research faculty and not the teaching faculty, which had the nice benefit that I never had to go to a faculty meeting and listen to my colleagues hitting sticks against logs. Well, what happened in the faculty meeting then, 6 years ago, was under the direction of Charles Cantor, who is now on leave from BU as Chief Scientific Officer of Sequinome, that our department had decided to go a very large multi-million dollar grant from the Whitaker Foundation to establish a program that would train students going from genes to cells to tissues to organs to whole body. I was not involved in any of those discussions, and it turned out that the department actually made it to the final round and they were going to be site visited. Charles Cantor knew I was doing some interesting things applying control principles at the whole body, pulled me into his office and says, Jim, I'm a little embarrassed. You're about to be site visited by this very idiosyncratic group of individuals who want to see us already demonstrating kind of bridging between levels. He says, we have nobody bridging any levels. Would you be willing to try to apply some engineering principles down at the level of genes and cells? He said he had a very interesting system that was essentially a cell suicide system that his group had designed, that was designed basically to gobble up some nutrient in his environment, and then once the nutrient was gone, it would kill itself. And he says, here are some equations. He knew we primarily started modeling in my group. Here are some equations. See what you could do. And I thought back and thought, okay, I'll give it a shot. Similar to how I said yes to Edith, I said, okay, yes, we'll give it a chance. As I'm leaving his office, he says, oh, Jim, I forgot to mention you have 4 days to come up with something. The site visit's on Friday. Well, we went running back to our lab, scrambled around for 3.5 days, and came up with absolutely nothing. The equations that he had did not describe the system. There was nothing interesting. I went back to his office and says, I'm sorry, Charles, we came up with nothing. He says, oh, that's okay. I still want to wheel you out and have you tell the group about what you think you could do. So the next day, as a junior faculty member, I actually get wheeled out and I have to give these half-baked notions about how engineering could be used at the level of genes. Well, in the end, we did not get the grant. Fortunately, the department did not hold it against me, and they brought me onto teaching faculty. But what was interesting that it resulted from this is then when we had more than 3.5 days to think about this problem, is that at the urging of Charles Cantor, my group began to look at what goes on at the level of DNA and genes and proteins and realized there were some fascinating engineering control principles. Just briefly here from this slide to take away is that DNA, which is a large molecule found in all living cells, its real prime focus or function is made up of various genes among other components. And what a gene does when it's turned on is it essentially leads to the production of a protein. And really the proteins are the workhorses of your cells. They're involved with essentially all biological functions. And it turns out there's some really fascinating ways of studying how do cells actually accomplish this. Well, when we got into the literature, we realized, and again, as I alluded already earlier, my group starts initially from the mathematics side, looking at modeling, is to give you a sense of the subcultures that continue to exist in biology and other branches of science, is that when we look to see had anybody been using mathematics or physics ideas to study how genes and proteins interact, as it turned out there was. There's this whole relatively large community of individuals that had been developing theory for the last 3 decades. And for the most part, what this group would do is take data from groups and use that to create some sort of mathematical model that they hope would match the data, and then they would make some predictions of their mathematical model. But this subculture, they talk commonly about the two cultures within, say, arts, humanities versus science, is these two cultures, in this case theory and experiment, in biology, actually were not talking. So this group that was looking at these models really was not getting back and convincing any of the experimentalists of the value of their predictions. Similarly, and in a larger group, you have the experimentalists, mentioned nicely by Jerry Weissman before in the last talk, is you have hundreds of labs looking at how genes are involved in producing proteins, but none of these groups really were involving primarily mathematical modeling to gain insight into these very complicated structures. So what we wanted to do was see, could we use engineering to begin to bridge this gap, to actually have an integrated approach that would basically use mathematical models in concert with experiments to gain new insight into how cells function, so that you could either build things for medical applications or at least gain new insights and understanding about how various living organisms function. Well, when we sat back, we kind of picking up on a theme that Ray had, was we first thought about, well, could you maybe use engineering principles, this won't fully fit, to reverse engineer underlying gene and protein networks. So by reverse engineer, the notion is given some existing system, can you use various experiments or models to pull out the underlying structure? It's actually the most common thing that you'll do in the modeling side, say in biology or in neurobiology, as Ray mentioned. Well, I look at this, here's a gene protein network in yeast. You know, I look at it and it looks like the Boston Tea system or maybe a butterfly ballot from Florida. Very, very complicated system. And there are absolutely many of my colleagues who can write down equations for all of these different components and actually construct a very large model. But I here co-direct the Center for Biodynamics, and my co-director is Nancy Capel, a very talented biomathematician. And what she likes to say is that if you give her a mathematical model with 900 parameters, so say 900 little knobs you could tweak, she can give you a camel. That is, that it's suitably large model. You can get anything you want from its output, and as a result, you get very little insight. And as a result, there's little utility, both from basic science and an applied science perspective. So instead of reverse engineering systems such as this, which is very hard, we ran as fast as we could from this problem. And with Tim Gardner, who was then a PhD student of mine, we decided, again, picking up on a theme that Ray mentioned, is kind of looking now at how you can maybe bridge information technology with biology, is instead of reverse engineering systems, we decided to see, could we forward engineer systems? So engineers, physicists, we tend to like to build things. So instead of studying what nature gave us, we wanted to see, could we take parts from nature and now build biological machines? So what we did was, we basically went after what we saw as low-hanging fruit in this arena and thought about using engineering principles now to begin to build artificial gene networks out of actually biological components with certain functions in mind. So the system that we first went after, let's see if I don't have a pointer, come up here, was a genetic toggle switch. It's a very simple system. This is now just an abstract picture. It's basically made of two different genes, repressor 2 and repressor 1. These are genes that basically want to shut each other off. Okay, so when a gene is turned on, as I mentioned, they produce a protein. So you set this system up so that these promoters are basically on switches to the respective genes. Promoter 1 is an on switch for gene 2, repressor 2. Promoter 2 is the on switch for repressor 1, gene 1. These on switches are always on in this system, and you set it up so that then the protein that's produced by gene 2 wants to basically bind, basically land on the on switch for gene 1 and shut it off. And similarly, the protein that's produced by gene 1, repressor 1, wants to basically land on the on switch for gene 2. This is promoter 1, shutting it off. So you have these two genes that are battling each other, trying to shut each other off. And it's in principle then, now this is just from schematic, just kind of sitting back at your desk here at BU, in principle then it should be possible to design a so-called bistable system. A system that could exist in one of two states. State 1, gene 1 is on and gene 2 is off, and in state 2, gene 2 is on and gene 1 is off. Okay, and in principle you should be able to flip the switch as you do in a light switch by just delivering some transient perturbation to your system that might be a chemical or some other change, an environmental change, that would shut down temporarily the gene that won, the gene that was on. Okay, so that's in general this notion of this switch, this toggle switch, which is actually a phrase from electrical engineering. Well, when we actually did the work that I'll show you just on a few slides, we wrote it up and sent it to our colleague Leon Glass and said, what do you think, Leon? He's a professor at McGill. And he says, oh, Jim, I hate to burst your bubble. And this was in, I think, 1999, but he said, there were several people who preceded you with very similar ideas. So, in fact, 3 years before the first Our Country, Our Culture symposium, and I don't know if any of you were as worried as I was from Jerry Weissman's slide that showed at the actual timing of the conference that the slope of life expectancy decreased significantly after that conference. I'm hoping we don't have a similar decrease after this conference. Yeah. But 3 years before the last conference, Max Delbruck, a physicist converted to biologist, had in a conference proceedings actually proposed, in this case, an enzymatic bistable network. And then about 12 years later, Minot and Jacob, really the great scientists underlying gene expression studies, had specifically proposed a genetic toggle switch in a conference proceedings. In each of these cases, they basically just laid out the idea. They didn't do any of the mathematics or the experiments, and primarily they didn't do the experiments because the techniques weren't in hand. But anyways, people had preceded us, and we duly noted their insights in our eventual paper. In brief, where we started then, Tim Gardner and myself, was on the modeling side. Now, I hesitated to put this up, keeping in mind what the publisher told Stephen Hawking when he was writing Brief History of Time, that for every equation he included in his book, he would cut his audience in half. And I was worried for every equation that I included, half of the audience here would fall asleep. With that said, I now have only about a quarter of you awake. Is that these two equations are basically just a simple representation of how these two genes would interact. What you have here are just what are so-called differential equations, where U can be viewed as the concentration of the protein from gene 1 and V is the concentration of the gene from protein, the protein from gene 2. This is just the synthesis rate, alpha 1 for gene 1, and alpha 2 is the synthesis rate for gene 2. And these are just degradation terms. When your proteins are produced, after some time, they actually degrade and disintegrate, essentially. It's a very simple equation that you can actually analyze to give you some insight into the dynamics. In brief, what we're showing here is in the protein space, where you're plotting the two proteins, that if you have a bistable system where the genes are more or less equal in strength, you can have basically then a system that has two states. State 1, where gene 1 wins and gene 2 loses, and state 2, where gene 2 wins and gene 1 loses. In, say, the monostable case, what happens here, the mathematics indicate, is that if one gene is a lot stronger than the other gene, then it will always win. So you have now not a bistable system, you have a monostable system, only one state, gene 1 always wins. So here, you basically have just an intersection at one point, where no matter where you start the system or what you do the system, gene 1 always dominates. And so you can imagine there are various scenarios. This is quite common in, say, competing species or even in business, and this would be the Microsoft example in gene toggle land, where if you're a lot stronger than everybody else, you always win any competition, and you're always on. Well, I can give a 50-minute talk of these types of mathematical presentations, and I know you're not interested. And it turns out the biologists, for the most part, are not interested in these types of presentations. And we realized that, Tim Gardner and myself. And we wanted to see, could we actually move this now to actually building this in real cells? So Tim Gardner, who actually was trained as an aerospace engineer, he actually spent time at Princeton as an undergraduate building helicopters, he and I began to go around talking to actual life scientists who work on real cells. Presented this to them and said, what do you think? Do you think this is a crazy idea? Do you think it could work? Well, they basically would say, you know, do you think it's interesting? They say, yes, I think it's interesting. Do you think it could work? No. Every single scientist that we talked to, every single one, on the order of about 10, when we asked, do you think we could get this to work in a real cell? And I bring this up to just show the cultural challenges when trying to bring stuff from other areas into disciplines, said, no, we don't think it could work. At the time, we'd convinced the Office of Naval Research to actually fund this work, and Tim Gardner went and made a presentation at an Office of Naval Research meeting. The program officer who was funding us called me the next day. I was not at the meeting. He says, Tim did a good job at the presentation. Nobody there thinks it can work. Everybody criticized, said it's not going to work. We then went back to Charles Cantor, who's a real cowboy in molecular biology. He says, Charles, what do you think? And he says, well, I think the idea is crazy enough that it should work. And two, that you guys are naive enough about how challenging it'll be that you two could get it to work. So with that, he actually gave us a chance to get into his lab. And what Tim and I then did was basically move toward using these engineering physics ideas to actually build basically a biological machine that was based on the toggle switch. So what you can do are create so-called plasmids that are circular rings of DNA, where you can take genes and different on switches, the promoters and other components, and basically glue them together using various chemical tools. And what you have here, just in short, are two different genes that are co-repressive, plus then a gene that's a fluorescent protein, or a gene that produces a fluorescent protein that can be used to basically monitor the activity of the system. Well, Tim actually got these into bacteria, so now these are living cells, and in brief, he was able to get the system to work. What have we done here? Well, this is an ad from Accenture, a company that used to be the consulting arm of Anderson Consulting. About a year and a half ago, they launched a new campaign to announce their name change, and they actually had ads that had fluorescing bacteria, or actually fluorescing cells, we debate whether these are bacterium, that actually then called up at the end of the ad, bacteria tested as digital circuit. And as I indicated, this toggle switch is really a biological analog for a electronic circuit, also known as a toggle switch, that actually lies at the heart of digital computers. Digital computers have various flip-flops in them. And here we again use now physics ideas to build this system that people said couldn't be built and actually got it working in cells. So hopefully to maybe inspire some discussion, what could you do with this toggle switch and related systems? And I'll end with this and also the next slide. Take a few minutes to walk through this. Well, our motivation for getting into this area of using engineering to build these biological machines was primarily originally from gene and cell therapy. So this is an exciting area that's actually gotten a lot of bad press, where the idea is essentially if you have a defective gene or you're missing an essential gene, that one could either use viruses or some other means to get a therapeutic gene into some fraction of cells of your body. And or in the cell therapy case, that you could take cells out of somebody's body, encapsulate them in some technology, get the genes of interest into those cells, and then get them back into the body. Very exciting. I think looking ahead, we're going to have much of medicine based in that arena. At some point, we're not there yet. But once we actually can figure out a way to get these genes into the body of patients that need them, the real challenge will be how do you regulate their expression? How do you make sure that the gene is on when it should be on? How do you make sure that it doesn't produce too much protein so that it's toxic? How do you make sure that it produces enough protein so it's effective? It turns out that there are already existing gene switches that you can actually buy. You can buy, get a catalog and buy switches. All of these switches are so-called pressure switches. So whereas this toggle switch, you only have to deliver, say, a drug very transiently, say, take a drug once to flip it from off to on, a pressure switch, which is actually already being used in some systems, needs to have a drug always present. The patient always has to take drugs to keep, say, the gene on. So when we've actually gone, and in some of the companies I'm involved with, when we've gone to talk to large pharmaceutical companies, wouldn't this be great? We could design a gene toggle switch that could be activated with just a single pill once, and that's all they'd have to take. The executives across the table invariably kind of look at us and say, why would you want to do that? And what is your business model? How do you ever make money from selling one pill? Well, it turns out it would be a great boon in that you can minimize side effects. You don't have to have a patient or a patient compliance. And so it's an exciting area that down the line I think we're going to see. In biosensors, you can actually modify the toggle. We've actually designed systems that can detect a small amount of a pathogen or a chemical in the environment. And it turns out that the Department of Defense and various other groups are very interested in actually coupling cells to chips, as Ray had referred to, as well as just dispersing cells that have been engineered into the environment, whether it's the water supply or in various other spots, to check for pathogens. And it turns out you can engineer these networks that can give you signals to indicate, okay, if there is anthrax or some other poison you need to worry about. In drug delivery systems, in addition to the toggle, there are various oscillators that our group and other groups have designed where you can, instead of just having a protein being produced at some constant level, you can have it produced periodically. It turns out that many of the chemicals that our body produces is not produced in kind of a bolus fashion, similar to the drugs that we take, but is actually produced in a periodic fashion aligned with our circadian rhythms and other physiological rhythms. And it turns out that these engineered biological machines can actually be used to better match the way that our body produces chemicals in order to have more effective drug treatments. In the whole area of biotechnology, as many of you are probably aware, there are various chemical companies, Dow, DuPont, Monsanto, which for decades have used biological cells to produce various proteins for different commercial purposes. So they have huge vats of cells. And it, basically, these groups are always looking for additional knobs that could increase their yield or improve their ability to produce proteins in an efficient, cost-effective way. More controversially, certainly in Europe and not so much over here yet, is the idea of using engineered genetic machines in the context of plants. So you already have genetically engineered plants. For instance, a farmer can go and buy plants that have drought-resistant genes put in them. It turns out in many cases such plants will have a lower yield. So a farmer has to make a commitment at the beginning of the season to protect against potential drought, but deal with a lower yield. Things like toggle switches or biological machines that are related could actually be used to actually help the farmer put off that decision, where he or she could buy a set of seeds that actually have the genes, say, under the control of a toggle, that would only need to be flipped later on in the season should there be a drought. Biocomputing and nanotechnology, Ray's already referred to this in many different ways in his talk very nicely, is that on the biocomputing side, there is a lot of interest right now in seeing what could you use in biological cells or what could you abstract or take, deduce from biological cells to improve computation. The toggle switch, for instance, as I said, I've already alluded to its analogous nature to digital flip-flops. It is really a simple form of biological memory. I don't think that anytime soon on the basis of toggle switches are we going to have jars of salmonella on our desks calculating our mortgage rates or our tax returns. For primary reason is that I actually don't, the wiring problem here is incredibly hard. But I do think that there are others who are actually moving towards that, and Ray mentioned the real advantage is you have this massive parallelism that can go on, as well as you have self-replication for the different components. But I think more broadly, and moving on to the nanotech side, is that biocomputing, I think if you broadly define it as the ability to program cells to perform different functions, we more or less are already there. We have engineering tools that can allow us to tweak and program cells to perform different functions within the body or in the environment. And there on the nanotech side, as Ray referred, basically cells are primarily at the micro level, so at the basically one millionth of a meter, whereas DNA is actually, or proteins are at the level of nano for the most part, so about one billionth of a meter. And so here, kind of thinking of nanobots, as Ray said, kind of in a wetter form where you actually have programmed cells, whether it's a red blood cell or the machinery within that cell that go around and perform different functions, we're getting pretty close. And finally, probably nearer to where these things can be used is in the functional genomics arena. There is, as Ray and Jerry noted, extreme interest now in understanding what do these genes do? What are all the genes and proteins that we've now mapped out, at least on the gene side that we've mapped out? What's their function? We are really a long way away from understanding the function of these genes and proteins, and a long way away from understanding the different networks underlying them. One of the tools that people use are transgenic animals. They basically go in and knock out genes in animals and see what happens to the way the animal behaves or lives or manifests different physiological function. The problem is that in many cases, these genes, if they are knocked out, the animal dies, it doesn't develop. So the idea is that you can use toggles of different systems to keep the gene on, then you can knock it out when the animal's older and actually knock it back in. Knock it back out, knock it back in as a reversible knockout. And finally, this notion of gene expression studies, I'll leave with this slide, picking up on kind of what Jerry was talking about, is the idea that you can use these engineering tools, and again, here's a good example of a merger of information technology with biology, moving towards medical application, is the idea that you can use toggle switches of these biological machines as tools that can go in to turn on and off one or more genes that you could use to reverse engineer the underlying network. The idea that maybe strikes home is that if you buy a new home, if in fact the owners, previous owners, don't have a very well mapped out fuse box or circuit breaker and didn't leave you any information about the underlying circuitry, you have to go into your basement and basically flip all the different switches to see what is it connected to and how are the different outlets in your house connected. You might have, say, a radio that you're going to plug around the house to see when does that radio turn on, depending on how you flip it, when does it turn off. And these are basically now the biological analog of doing that for the underlying networks in our cells. And it's with that information that we can then actually guide the design of better drugs and identify then multiple targets of these genes or proteins that could combat disease and various other problems. So why don't I end there and open it up to the panel.
Boston University Professor James Collins. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. You're listening to excerpts from the conference on Our Country, Our Culture, 1952 to 2002, sponsored by the Partisan Review. Tonight's topic is the ascendance of science and technology. Now, Professor Collins, Raymond Kurzweil, and Gerald Weissman respond to the question, should we call a halt to certain kinds of scientific inquiries because of Faustian dangers? First, Raymond Kurzweil.
I think it's one way of bringing up the ethical dimension. Ethical debates about technology have increased, and it's a little bit of an oblique answer, but I'll relay one dialogue that I've been a part of, which started in a bar in Lake Tahoe 3.5 years ago with Bill Joy, who's a noted technologist, and I gave him an advance copy of my book. And in my first book in the 1980s, it was criticized for being for not really focusing on the dangers of technology enough, and so I decided I would focus on that in The Age of Spiritual Machines. And he really picked up on that aspect of it, on some of the downside scenarios that these technologies would make possible, and he's pretty much devoted himself to that issue. About 8 months later, came out with an article, it was a cover story in Wired magazine called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, expounding the dangers of GNR, genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics. And that kind of set off a firestorm, kind of like when Soros came out against capitalism. Being an arch capitalist, got a lot of attention. Bill Joy is an arch technologist. He's the founder of Sun Microsystems. He invented Java and other major technologies we use in the computer field. And he was sort of sounding the alarm on the dangers of technology, so it's gotten a lot of attention. At last count, there have been about 10,000 articles written about Bill Joy's article. And so he and I have been paired very often as sort of myself as the optimist and him as the pessimist with regard to technology futures. However, I do recognize the dangers, and I think the argument, the ethical argument, is not to minimize the dangers, which a lot of people do. I was at one of these discussions at Harvard a few months ago. One Nobel Prize-winning biologist said, referring to the danger of nanotechnology run amok, self-replicating nanotechnology entities that could self-replicate and form a non-biological cancer. He said, we're not going to see that for 100 years. And I said, actually, that's a pretty good estimate of the amount of technical progress needed to achieve that milestone at today's rate of progress. But since we're doubling the paradigm shift rate every 10 years, we'll make 100 years of progress in the next 25 years. So I don't think it's fruitful to argue that these things won't happen. And we are confronted with some grave dangers, and I think first we need to examine those. The closest at hand are abuse of biotechnology, the same technology that's going to cure cancer and save millions of people from disease can also allow a terrorist to create a bioengineered pathogen. And it's not that difficult. I mean, the knowledge is becoming at hand to do that. And so a lot of people would say, well, we really shouldn't go down that path because it's too dangerous, and you can describe some pretty dire scenarios. And I think if you described today to people 200 years ago enough nuclear weapons to wipe out all mammalian life on Earth, just for starters, people would think it mad to go down this path. But conversely, very few people today would really want to go back 200 years. I mean, most of us wouldn't be here, for one thing, with an average lifespan of about 37 years 200 years ago. Most 99% of the human race lived lives of dire poverty, disaster-prone, poverty-filled, labor-intensive. And we've not completely, but largely, liberated ourselves from many of these things. We have a tremendous economic imperative to go forward, which is why we will go forward. Underlying the economic imperative, in my mind, is a moral imperative. We still have not millions, but billions of people who live in poverty, who are suffering from diseases, which we are fairly close at hand within, in some cases, 10 years or 20 or 30, we'll be able to overcome many of these afflictions that are age-old. So I think we have a moral imperative to move forward. All of these dangers have to do with self-replication. Disease is self-replication, and we'll be able to manipulate disease so that we can amplify the destructive potential of technology there. Self-replicating nanotechnology could be even more powerful. Killer robots, then, is several decades away. Maybe these super AIs won't be friendly to us anymore. I think we can take some comfort from experience we've had with one new form of pathogen, which is self-replicating, which is human-made, which didn't exist 30 years ago, and that's the software virus. And when these first appeared, people said, well, okay, these first software viruses are primitive, but as they get more and more sophisticated, which they will, they're going to shut down computer networks, and computer networks will be destroyed. Part of that prediction did come true. The software viruses have gotten more and more sophisticated, but they have not shut down our networks because the technological immune system, our defensive systems, have evolved along with the offensive systems and have really kind of kept pace with the dangers. No one would suggest shutting down the Internet because of software viruses. They're really pretty much of a nuisance. Now, people might say, well, software viruses don't generally kill people. These new dangers, such as a bioengineered pathogen, could be quite destructive on a lethal basis. But that really only strengthens my argument because software viruses generally don't only destroy files and don't kill people. They could kill people if they get into mission-critical systems, but in general they don't. We're fairly lackadaisical about it, and yet we've done pretty well at keeping them at bay with these types of self-replicating pathogens that are human-made that could be potentially lethal. The law enforcement response, our diligence, the efforts put into technological immune systems will be hundreds of times more intense. So we're likely to do even better. But I would say that this is the primary issue facing human civilization in the century ahead. We have the potential to really transform humanity and liberate ourselves from a lot of affliction and suffering, but we're also facing grave dangers. We have to face them both. I think on balance, I mean, if we look at today, we see profound benefit and profound danger. 50 million people died in World War II. We had 100 million people killed in wars in the 20th century, made possible by technology. So we are suffering from the dangers of technology. On balance, I'd say that we're better off, but it's not an easy question. We don't have a clear boundary of who we are today. We don't necessarily identify with every part of our body. We don't. I mean, how much do we identify with who we are? Who we are changes constantly. Most of our cells change. I'm a completely different set of cells than I was just a few weeks ago. And even the neurons, which persist longer, the particles making them up are completely changed. It's really a pattern of information is what we are. And as we learn what that pattern is, we can enhance it. We're well down the path. We already have augmentations and replacements for many different body parts, and we're beginning to do that with the brain. There's actually, as I mentioned before, relatively little controversy. The controversy comes up to some extent when we start manipulating biological information. The ecological community has tried to create a boundary there that we shouldn't tamper with the sacred ground of our biological makeup, which is kind of artificial. Because the whole history of medicine and now amplified by our genomic and proteomic information, which is just starting, allows us to manipulate the nature of our biological information as well. And there's tremendous energy pushing these things forward. I mean, we're not going to tell the community of people suffering from cancer, well, we're on the verge of great breakthroughs that will save millions of lives, but we're canceling all that because, A, the dangers, B, it might encroach on sacred ground of the boundary between human and machine. The forces pushing these things forward, economic, moral, and so forth, are really pretty overwhelming.
Raymond Kurzweil responding to the question of whether or not we should halt certain avenues of scientific inquiry. Dr. Gerald Weissman now addresses the same question.
Great fears have been raised about what the new biology and technology can do to our sense of what it is to be human. Putting myself in a position of a 4th century Greek, were I to foresee that such diseases, the three main diseases of humankind, which began in the Middle East, would have killed those millions of people for one form of religion or the other, I would be astonished at what horrible force had been launched by the virus of monotheism. Ludwig Büchner wrote a book called Kraft und Stoff, He was a brother of George Büchner, who wrote Danton's Tote. And he was one of the first reductionist physicians of the 19th century to say that force and matter are one, and that there really is no difference between the animate and the inanimate in one sense, except for human values. Those values can be defined by societies as we wish, with hierarchical, humanistic, liberal, or conservative forms, as you wish. But in terms of the biology, is bone alive or is it dead? Is a tooth alive or is it dead? And everyone worries that you're going to create a, quote, cyborg, a term coined in 1960 by the founder of psychopharmacology, Nathan Klein. But the point is, we all are cyborgs to a degree. And I think that kind of distinction is important when you discuss about human values. I'm willing to discuss the difference between a Monet and a Chuck Close. I'm not willing to discuss the difference between me and a stone because we both oxidize and age. Stones oxidize. A paper turns brown. The same biochemical processes age us. The difference is we can change all three by coating a stone, by treating paper to be acid-free, and by giving drugs to human beings. We can do all of that. The difference is these things don't have values. We do, and I think we ought to keep those two realms separate.
Dr. Gerald Weissman answering the question, should we call a halt to certain kinds of scientific inquiries because of Faustian dangers, as part of a partisan review discussion on the ascendance of science and technology in the last half century. You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. Now to answer the same question, Professor James Collins of the School of Engineering.
In addition to the gene work, my group here does a fair amount of work on designing devices to enhance sensory function, so designing sensory prosthetics. And I would actually agree with Ray that I have seen very little controversy in terms of this interface of the body with machines. In particular, I've seen very little of any controversy where we have instances that these devices and machines are used to enhance, or I should say, to replace lost function. So an individual who, as a result of age, disease, or an injury, has lost a function, I've never heard complaints. Where I'm beginning to see controversy and hearing complaints is as the technology is getting better and cheaper, and people are beginning to think about using the medical, biomedical technology for enhancing function in healthy individuals. So having a technological edge so that whether it's actually outside the context of virtual reality, but in terms of giving you an edge in, say, a sporting event. There's actually a lot of controversy right now in the sporting world to what extent individuals are already using gene or cell therapy to enhance their performance, to boost either capacity to carry blood oxygen through their blood to various ports and or to create stronger or bigger muscles. And I think we as a bioengineering community are going to be facing some interesting challenges in the next decade on this.
Just an interesting aside about oxygen and sporting events. There's a design for something called a respirocyte, which is actually a robotic red blood cell. And this design has been, it's not a completed project, but it appears that it would work. If you had these respirocytes inside you, you could do an Olympic sprint for 16 minutes without taking a breath. And they would be very hard to detect, but assume you could detect them. Presumably, we'll ban them in Olympic sporting events, and they'd be detected. But what's going to happen then is you're going to have the Olympic kids in junior high school gymnasiums routinely outperforming the Olympic athletes because the kids will be using them.
Let me ask one other question relating this to the subject of the conference or indirectly to the subject of the conference. And Gerald, you made a point in your talk several times about really the impact and power of entrepreneurial effort as opposed to sort of a public declaration of intention as far as technological advance is concerned in knowledge. And actually, both Ray and Jim are entrepreneurs and inventors as well as scientists. So to what extent is all of this related to American culture right now, that the sort of dominance of America technologically and scientifically? Is American importance in these areas related to the entrepreneurial idea, or is there something else involved?
Well, I think, we are a frontier. We have a frontier culture of embarking on new frontiers, whether it's opening up a new area of our country or going to the moon or new technological or scientific or cultural frontiers. We also are the only country really organized from all of the world's peoples, which gives us kind of ready access through our knowledge of all the different markets in the world. And I think it's fairly coincident with the primary difference of our species from other species. We are the only species that tries to expand our potential. Other species use tools, but those tools never evolve from one generation to another. There's no expanding species-wide or even clan-wide knowledge base. We have language, so we have a way of recording and sharing knowledge. We have an exponentially exploding knowledge base, and we use it to expand our own potential and to go beyond any limitation. First, controversies come up along the way, but they tend to be like stones in a stream. The flow of progress goes around them. And that is really the inherent, I think, unique aspect of that distinguishes Homo sapiens and has made us the kind of cutting edge of evolution.
But I think the question was mainly directed towards our country, our culture, in a sense, the culture of the United States. It's no accident that each of the three people here has been involved with private biotechnological enterprises. And the mixture of both public and private, one goading the other, is very useful in this context. Absent the support of basic science by our universities and our governments, we'd be nowhere. Absent private enterprise with its competitive edge, we'd still be nowhere. It's the two together that have made this rather unique mix. Other countries have done extremely well in biotechnology and in education, and much of the Western world is moving pretty much in step. There's something exciting, however, about the loci and foci of biotechnology and universities in the United States, around Stanford, around Boston, around Princeton, etc. Interestingly enough, those states that drill for oil exclusively don't think as well and don't have these kind of biotechnological developments. They are lag behind compared to the public input for example, Texas, which ought to be one of the great centers of biotechnology, is not. Why they make megabucks on oil? It's like Saudi Arabia. If you get it from the ground, you don't have to make it from your head. And so I would suggest that the advantage that we have in terms of biotechnology and thought in places like Boston, Princeton, San Diego, and Silicon Valley give America an edge that parts of Europe, such as Cambridge, Ireland, Israel, Sweden also have. But that's part of the advancing West, and it's got to be public and private, and it's been a great mix.
I'll make a brief comment on that, is that I'm a similar proponent for the mix of private and public and have actually benefited greatly. But I'm worried about some trends in this arena where I see that some universities are moving a little bit too much toward the private side, and that is actually preferentially rewarding the faculty who are entrepreneurial, involved more on the applied side. And I myself am one of them. I don't do basic science, but I have incredible respect and value for basic science because those are the guys that I exploit. I take their results and use their results to develop technology. And if basic science doesn't have a strong supportive home in universities, it's not going to get done anywhere else. That's one. Two, the thing that I'm finding more and more now as an applied scientist in a university setting is that many more of my colleagues are getting involved with companies. And as a result, many of my colleagues are now reluctant to share the information that's coming out of their labs. Folks are saying, well, I can't tell you, I'm under a confidential agreement with this company, I'm working with them. Boy, you're working that other company, their competitors, I can't talk to you. And as a result, potential collaborations that could be beneficial within the academic settings actually are now being squashed as a result of commercial interests. And again, I'm a great proponent of transferring the technology out of the universities into companies, but these are dangers that I'm seeing becoming more and more prevalent.
I just want to make one comment on that. That was also true in the academic world even before that. That kind of competition is around, as anyone in the humanities will also recognize readily, and it was put into words by the late Jack Whitehead of the Whitehead Institute, who said, Jerry, let me tell you, the difference between academia and business. In business, it's dog eat dog, and in academia, it's the opposite.
I'll raise I'll raise one other issue and then ask for some questions. And this is actually the issue of the view of science held by varieties of American culture. I mean, there are really two poles. On the one hand, absolute sort of fascination and going back to the 1950s and the sort of ambition of competition internationally with Sputnik, et cetera, to the love of innovation. And on the other hand, a distrust of the idea of progress, of scientific knowledge as a form of, desiccate, and the Norman Mailer quote that you had, the sort of the countercultural anti-scientific view that has its roots in Romanticism. So these two strains seem to run along in American culture. Any comments on
It also has its roots in the Luddite movement, which emerged in the English textile industry around 1800, when these weavers, who for generations had enjoyed a certain livelihood, had that business model of their families turned on its head. And it seemed apparent to the Luddites that since one person could do the work of 12, and as these machines got more and more sophisticated, and there were new machines coming out every year, ultimately employment would be enjoyed by only a small elite. What happened, though, is that because human desire and ambition grows along with opportunity, people didn't just want one shirt. They wanted a whole wardrobe of shirts, and the common man and woman could have well-made clothing for the first time, and then there were whole new industries grew up to transfer these well-made clothes around and to build the machines and so forth. And if you look at the trends, we've had tremendous growth in employment, both in terms of average pay, productivity, number of jobs. The whole education level required for jobs has increased. But that's been one route, is the effect on unemployment, which is one aspect of human dignity. And we do have these two poles. They're both growing. The power of technology is growing. So we definitely see stronger anti-technology voices. We see also much more strength of technology because its economic and social impact is growing. I think the right response to the concerns of technology is not to dismiss them, because technology is a double-edged sword. It does have a downside. There are unintended consequences. It amplifies our powers, both creative and destructive, as I pointed out earlier. So I think for someone who overall supports ongoing technological progress, it's important to be mindful of some dangers which are growing, and some of which are quite grave. And we saw September 11th, the harnessing of technology, not the latest ones, but those were technologies, airplanes and buildings. And there are some trends, I think, that are important that can mitigate these types of problems, like decentralization. The Internet is a relatively safe place to be, whereas congregating people in buildings and airplanes in cities is less safe. But I think you can see both of these movements growing as the power of technology grows, and as, in fact, the benefit, the promise and the peril of technology are growing. Arts, creativity, emotional intelligence, that is the cutting edge of human intelligence. I mean, so when we talk about replicating human intelligence, I'm not really just talking about analytical thinking and logical deduction. I mean, machines are already actually pretty good at that already. The most complex thing we do, the most advanced thing that we do, is emotional intelligence, creativity, intuition, these kinds of subtle qualities. But these do stem from the human brain and from the interaction of our brain with the accumulating human knowledge. And these are things that we will master and be able to amplify our human intelligence when we understand the principles of operation of the brain. Now, some people have said, oh, well, inherently we're intelligent, but we're below the threshold where we're intelligent enough to understand our own intelligence. But as this process moves forward of really understanding ourselves in this kind of fundamental way, we're realizing that's really not the case. We are capable of understanding in some depth how human intelligence works. And that will give us the knowledge to overcome human dysfunction, and also to expand human ability and human creativity. There are many intriguing examples of that already, in which machines can amplify our creativity. But ultimately, we will actually be able to be more expressive and more human in the positive sense of the word.
One of the things that excites me, moving in more and more into the life sciences, particularly cell and molecular biology, is how little we actually understand and know at present within the biological sciences. So we've presented basically success stories, and I think any time you can develop a technology and on the basis of some understanding and or modify function, you demonstrate you understand at least something. But when you get even the function of a single cell and the different genes and proteins going on there, we know very little. It's actually very disturbing at one hand, given what we hope to get from medicine when we go to see a doctor presently. But as a scientist, it's very exciting. And it's going to take us a long time to then even go from understanding of how single cells work to how groups of cells, let alone many billions or trillions of cells, function. Within the arena of biology, there's a technique referred to as directed evolution, where scientists will actually introduce mutations or changes in some aspect of a cell or an organism and push the organism toward a desired function. There's actually a company called Maxigen on the West Coast that is designing drugs utilizing these principles. We are very interested in, for instance, seeing could we utilize those principles in the context of our biological machines to improve their function. So could we, for instance, design a genetic toggle switch that is faster in the way it switches? And we've shown that you can do this computationally. The challenge is now how to actually do this in a real biological lab. And what I learned through my last few years when we did experiments in these living cells is these experiments are really hard and really slow. And I have a grad student right now exploring how you could evolve biological machines with better function and not yet unknown function. And the unknown function would be something we'd move down the line.
Professor James Collins, speaking at this spring's conference sponsored by the Partisan Review on Our Country, Our Culture, the Changing Role of Intellectuals, Artists, and Scientists in America, 1952 to 2002. Join us next week as we mark Father's Day with an archived roundtable discussion of the relationship between children and fathers and children. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15 and include shipping and handling. To learn more about Boston University's World of Ideas, visit our website at buwi.org. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild, with help from Tina Tobey and Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Have a good evening.